My name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. Who's that back there cheering for Campy Saturday breakfast meeting? There we go. That best meeting this, well, I always say this side of the Mississippi. So if you ever get a chance to visit it, please do. I'll buy you breakfast. My name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic, right? So sobriety date, January 24th, 2007, which gives me 19 years. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. That's important. I have hold two active service positions, service for me and Alcoholics Anonymous. Very important. And I've worked the 12 steps several times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I work with new guys, and that's what keeps this alcoholic in the middle and keeps me sober and sane today. I'm a firm believer in Rule 62. I don't take myself too seriously. If you're looking for a serious speaker, you can just go out there and take a nap. I'll be done in about 2.5 hours. I want to thank Christine for picking me up at the airport and running me around, and Diane for inviting me down here. And you guys have been great company. You've been great. I want to thank the committee, everybody that's put this together. Bill, I know a lot of work goes into this. I always say the speakers get the most applause, literally, for the least amount of work. So a lot of work goes into this through the years. So one more round of applause for these guys. I mean, honestly. So. My new friend, Michaeline, I found my spirit animal in her. She was comfortable enough. I've been getting, like, she has the I Love Rule 62 license plate out there. And anybody that can call me Fat Boy within 2 hours of meeting me on just, hey, Fat Boy, get over here. I was like, all right, I think I love this lady, right? So I've had a blast down here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, man. If anything comes across tonight, I hope it's the love I have for Alcoholics Anonymous, the love I have for dragging the newcomers in here. Welcome anybody that's new, all the people that are under a year, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in the fifth tradition. The only thing that I'm doing up here tonight is carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Now, that might be somebody out here with, 68 years, Jimmy? I mean, I don't know. You know, we never know who's in the room. This might be somebody's first meeting. It might be somebody's last meeting. I hope you hear something. I hope you feel something that keeps you coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. And the new lady, 24 hours, welcome. I've said all I needed to hear tonight. So if you want to come up and just take over the mic for me, you can do that. So one thing, they told me to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous when I came in, until nobody looked old anymore. And I was just about ready to graduate up in Oregon. They sent me to Yuma, and I'm like, shh, I gotta put in like 30 or 40 more years down here. So I see the old timers aren't laughing because they can't hear me, I don't think. And so I've gotta stick around for a while longer. I'm sorry if that's offensive. I'm a repeat offender. I will offend again before this is over. So I'll get a little bit into my story. I grew up in a little tiny town, Eddyville, Oregon. If you haven't heard of Eddyville, nobody in Oregon has. Oh, there's one out there. There's always a couple. Nobody in Oregon has really heard of Eddyville either. It's a tiny little town. I graduated 19 kids in my class, pretty much the same 19 that I started school with. And I was a country boy through and through. It was a reforestation, logging community, mill work. It was super blue collar. That's all there was out there. We were in the sticks in the hills of Oregon. I always say I come from Eddyville, where men are men, so are the women, right? Everybody has calluses on their hands. So it's like, there was no slow, that's the way it was. You know, everybody worked, everybody, you know. And I had a good time out there. I had a good childhood. My grandpa was head of sales for Olympia Brewing Company. That was the big beer back in the 70s. We had Olympia everything, you know. I lived out, and there was, I always say hunting season was all season long for my dad. You know, that's just that we lived kind of a backwoods outlaw lifestyle. My parents were both functioning alcoholics. My grandpa was a functioning alcoholic. It was all around me. You know, there was other stuff that was around me because the reforestation guys were more a little bit on the hippie side, you know, growing up. So there was all sorts of stuff. Some of that stuff's illegal. It was just part of the culture, right? The drinking, when I can say I grew up around everybody drank around me, everybody drank, and that's the way it was. Remember taking my first drink of alcohol. I was probably 4 or 5 years old. I'm not going to say I started drinking at that time, but that's how accessible it was. My dad would have these big company parties, and the guys would pass around booze, and I'm talking whiskey, and the guys would think it's funny, and I take a big drink of it, and, you know, it didn't taste good, but I remember that, right? And it just was part of life. I didn't start drinking on a regular basis until I was probably 15 years old. And I drank alcoholically from the time that I started drinking. I am not the guy that's going to say I sat up here and I felt a part of. I drank because I was depressed or didn't fit in. I lived, like I said, 19 kids in my class. We all played sports together. We grew up together. We spent our summers together. It was like growing up with a family, right? So everybody was kind of a part of. I never felt separate. But when I ingested alcohol, I absolutely loved. I always say I kind of unleashed demons inside me, right? And I had a good time. And it was, you know, we used to do bonfires and, you know, the fighting and, you know, everything goes into the country, the four-wheeling, all that stuff. And I had a great time, you know, and I was the kid that would get thrown up drunk every single weekend and couldn't wait to do it again. And I'm talking every single weekend. And what makes me an alcoholic is just that, you know, once I ingest alcohol, somebody talked about it earlier, I have that abnormal reaction, I have the allergy that makes me automatically want to drink more alcohol. Now, I grew up knowing I was an alcoholic. Everybody called an alcoholic. You come into Alcoholics Anonymous through the court system, I'm an alcoholic, because that's just what people say. But when I finally came in here and read the doctor's opinion, I understood what an alcoholic was, right? I just don't drink. I have the obsession of the mind, and I have an allergy. And connected, that just, I can't get enough alcohol in me once I start drinking. And but I didn't want to stop, right? I couldn't get enough alcohol in me when I was younger. So it was like I drank and drank and drank and had a great time. All the trouble, all the consequences didn't slow me down, right? And there's a part in the big book where it talks about the hard drinker, problem drinker. You know, at a certain period of time, if something, the consequences are bad enough, I get a DUI or I get in my wife threatens to leave me or whatever it is, a lot of hard drinker, they can just put the plug in the jug. You know, if there was ever a point like that in my life, in this alcoholic's life, I blew right past it, you know, because all the consequences, none of that stuff was slowing me down. It just, you know, no matter what happened, and I'll get into some of that. You know, my first DUI, I'm going to take the, you guys all saw the jacket, right? So I'm getting rid of it. So. met that requirement. The tie comes off next. So, so hold on one sec. So, hold on, I got to start this over. Just a sec, guys. All right. So, where was I? What was I? Was I an alcoholic yet? Okay, so, anyway, yeah, so I started drinking my first DUI. I was 18 years old. I moved over to I graduated from high school at the age of 17. I went into high lead logging. This is Oregon, you know, we're falling 200-foot, you know, trees. Bucking those up, dangerous job. I know a lot of guys that have been killed and maimed hold on. I'm just going to watch the time. So I know a lot of guys that have been killed and maimed in the logging industry. But when you're doing that at 17 years old, right, you go in and they feed you beer just like you're an adult. It doesn't matter. So you're out drinking at the back of the crew cab after the day's over. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, 18, of legal age or not. And a lot of us were young, 18, 19, 20 years old, and we drank. And I drank alcoholically. And I got my first DUI. I was 18 years old. That's where I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to go in and get my slip signed, the whole nine yards. You know, I did the outpatient treatment. And nothing was slowing me down. But I did try the Alcoholics Anonymous. And they sent me to this, it was a Thursday night meeting. I moved over to the big city of Philomath, which was about 4,000 people. They had police officers there, so that was new for me. And so I go in and I sit in this meeting. There was probably 10 people there. The average age was hospice. And I was 18. So I'm like, I'm like, so they're going around. I'm like, I was like, these people are old. There's a So the topic was serenity. I had no idea what they were talking about. I remember this old lady. She was like 40 or 50, like was said earlier. And she says, my idea of serenity is I just stay home on a Friday night and I pet my cat. And I'm like, we're in two different places here, right? Now I look back, I'm like, maybe she was hitting on me. I was only 18 years old. I have no idea what was going on. I have a whole different idea what might have been happening now. But I was out of there, right? And I found out real soon it was an anonymous program. So I just went out and I started signing my own slip. And so that was, and I don't recommend that if you're new. I really don't. And so by the time I was out of there, they'd put me on Anabuse. I got another MIP, minor in possession. None of this makes me an alcoholic. It just goes to show that when I drink, when I ingest alcohol, nothing's going to be different tonight if I do the same thing. I make horrible decisions. I'm super impulsive. And it brings out just this crazy strength in me, or streak in me. And put me on Anabuse, which was basically court-appointed poison. And so, which is the truth, they put it, a lot of you guys, I'm sure, know about it. And so you go down to the pharmacy, they'd give you a little shot, and you would take this shot of poison. They say, don't drink on it, because you can become deathly ill, could possibly die sick. And I'm like, well, I'll give it a shot, right? I'm like, what's the worst that could happen? And so I didn't die. My blood pressure would go, I mean, I could feel my heart pounding. Anybody that's, I'm sure there's some crazy person in here that's drank on Anabuse. And my blood pressure would just raise. And I would turn, I'm not exaggerating, lobster boiled red. And to the point where I'd be driving through town, my buddy would be like, Aaron, what was wrong with you yesterday when I saw you driving through town? I'm like, I was just trying a little controlled drinking on Anabuse. Seemed to be going all right, right? And it just made it unenjoyable. And that it just made it unenjoyable to the point where I wrapped that up. So that's just the way I drank. And, you know, I said consequences, not in my vocabulary. And I just kept the pedal to the metal, you know. And so from there, I was married and divorced by the age of 19. My wife thought I was going to settle down and quit drinking. You know, that's what adults do. We met partying, and that just didn't happen for me. And so I had a boy. You know, he was out of my life, and I walked out on my family, you know, by the age of 20. And so I started getting into some other stuff. I won't get into, well, you know, some people call them outside issues. I call them drugs, right? It's, let's just call it what it is. Started getting into some other stuff where I touched in on the weekends because I wanted to expand my weekend. I did hard work. And so by the time I was off school, I'm making an excuse up here. I liked what they did for me, right? So somebody gives me something at a party and it wakes me up and I'm a wide awake drunk. Alcohol for sure is my first demon. My sponsor always said it was my last demon. In between there is a whole lot of the other stuff going on, right? And from there, you know, I go off and I start getting in more trouble. I do a lot of county jail time. I do more treatments. By the age of 24, I've got a 19 to 24-month prison sentence hanging over my head. And I'd just gotten out of treatment, did six months in jail, just gotten out of a 56-day treatment program. And within 24 or 48 hours, you know, you give me a lie detector test when I'm taken off out of there, and I'm going to pass it, right? That I'm not drinking. I'm coming back to see so-and-so's graduation next week. We're good buddies. We're going to do all this. And I'm out doing the same thing. I'm out seeing the girl I'm not supposed to be seeing. I'm drinking what I'm not supposed to be drinking. I'm doing what I'm not supposed to be doing. And I have this prison sentence hanging over my head. 3 months later, I get picked up out of a bar in the middle of this bar scuffle. And I know right then I'm going to prison. You know, they'd given me just enough rope to hang myself. And so my dad at that time said, is there anything, you know, can I come down and speak on my son's behalf? And he had asked my attorney, he said, at that point he wanted anybody to come down and speak on my behalf, right? And so he said, yeah. So what my dad did is he came down and the judge brought him up. And that's one of the most heartbreaking moments my dad said he ever had as a father. I was a kid that I got along good, you know, in school. I got along with my classmates. I got along with my teachers. You know, we had a good time. Like I said, it was family. I played sports. And he says, I watched my son come in, you know, shackled and chained to five other guys where nobody's there to show them support either, right? And it's at the last end of the block. What my dad says is he gets up there before the judge. He says, this is my son. he's becoming institutionalized. He's a danger to himself and he's a danger to society, and please give him the maximum amount of time as you can give him. And I thought it wasn't too funny at the time. I kind of look back and chuckle now. It wasn't funny. My attorney didn't think it was funny. So, that's what they did. And so I won't get into all that. You know, it's just that's where drinking took me. And that's where drinking, honestly, would probably take me tonight if I go out there, right? I don't make good decisions. I'm a chronic drunk driver. You know, I do everything that I'm not supposed to do. And it all starts with that one drink, right? And so I go several years, and I get in there, go out. I move up to the big to Portland to get away from the drugs and alcohol. And, you know, brilliant. So if anybody knows Portland at all. And so I ended up living with my aunt for 3 years. My uncle was kind of a local legend guitarist. Moved in with them, so it wasn't like Ozzy and Harriet, but I started drinking again. And I would go out to my uncle's gigs, and I would drink, and then I would go do my own thing. And it was just that cycle, right? And the cycle, I'd get into some other stuff. I'd say I got away from the criminal behavior, but I was still chronic drunk driver, the whole nine yards. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And you know, 3 years later, you know, I was supposed to be going to school. I was flunking out of school. I didn't have a job. And my aunt said, you know, Aaron, we've done all we can do for you, and you're going to have to move on, you know. And so that's what I did. I lied to get a good union job. I had a criminal history that was following me around. So I lied on the application to get in the door, and I got a good union job. And I'd passed the UAs, got in there. Went, I think, a week or two without drinking, and I realized, you know, I'm working swing shift. I get off at 12:30 in the morning. There's three bars right across the street. We're Teamsters. We go over there and we shut the bar down. The difference is between us and 90% of the people out there is they can go out, they can have a few beers, get up with their kids in the morning, whatever it is, go home, make dinner, you know, whatever it is, go run errands the next day. And for me, for the alcoholic, I take that drink and I just can't stop. So most of the time I'm not showing up the next day. You know, I keep doing what I'm doing, and it's just a progression. And this was to the point, that was in 99, I got that job. And I think it was early 2001 was the first time that I went up to the general manager, and I just said, I kind of threw in the first time I was ever honest. And I said, I laid down all my write-ups and all the times I'd missed work, and I said, all this is due to alcohol, right? And I have a serious drinking problem. I need to get some help. And so they let me do an outpatient program at that time. And like a lot of us, I clean up, start doing what's right. I feel good. I have to take UAs, so I'm disciplined. I go through the whole thing, and I'm starting to jump into some 12-step meetings, check out the other sister program. I come in Alcoholics Anonymous, make sure you guys are still doing your thing. Still looks for good for you. I'm sitting in the back on death row, and I scoot out the back after the meetings, right? I don't get to know anybody. And I don't want to commit because I have that lurking reservation, right, that something I just don't want to quite give it my all. Now, I want to quit drinking, but there's something in me, in my heart, in my head, I'm telling you, I'm going to quit drinking. My heart, there's something I know that's just holding me back from 100% telling the truth, from becoming part of, right? So I'd scoot out the back, and I made it. I was in the middle of that, and a young lady by the name of Megan, she came out to work at the warehouse. I worked with like 300 guys at the warehouse distribution center and about five women. So they're all 10s, perfect 10s, right? It's like working in a prison. No, I'm just, but she was a very beautiful young lady. And and she asked me out, and I was sober at the time. And what I didn't know is her dad worked graveyard at the end of the other end of the warehouse. We'd never crossed shifts. He looked like a bulldog. He had put out some sort of memo that nobody was to date his daughter down on that end. I didn't get the memo on swing shift. So you know how it goes. Automatically, I'm on the list. And so he didn't want to meet me. He had asked all sorts of questions about me, you know how that goes, and but I start dating his daughter, and we clean up, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I got sober, I was going to work, I was doing everything, and I'm a decent human being so far, right, in that, and we started dating more and more, and I knew it was going to go somewhere, and it's the first time I took somebody in my life, and I sat her down. She wasn't a drinker, didn't do any outside issues, and I just said, hey, if we're going to progress with this, there's something you got to know. You know, she'd never seen me drink, didn't know anything about my past. I said, you know, I have a serious alcohol problem, and if I drink, you're going to have to leave. You know, I want you to leave. I did not want to drag this lady through the mud. Absolutely not. And so put together, her dad wouldn't meet me for a lot of months. He finally met me after 6 or 7 months. He had me up for a very silent dinner and finally summoned me into the next room. And he's this old hillbilly, and he's got his whole closet full of guns behind him on display, right? And looks like this just crazy bulldog dad. And then he said, Aaron, he goes, here are the three things I do not like about you. And the whole conversation went downhill after that. And it wrapped up with, and that's my little girl out there. If you do anything to hurt her, I have no problem going to prison for any one of my kids. And I'm like, and I believed him. And I believe him to this day. You know, that's the way it was. He was dead serious. And so that was my first, you know, meeting with my future father-in-law. And so after 9 months, I ended up, Megan and I had moved in together, and things were going good, and I went back to visit a friend of mine in South Dakota, and I ended up, I go out to the bar and order a beer, and he's like, you don't have to do that. That's the only way that I knew how to connect, right? We'd known each other since we were kids. The only way I knew how to connect. He's like, you really don't. He knew I had some sobriety. And I sat that beer down there, and being an alcoholic like I am, talk about the obsession of the mind, right? And I don't care if it sits there for 24 seconds or 24 minutes or 24 hours. As soon as I start thinking about it, I have no higher power, no defense against that first drink. I'm going to drink it eventually. And that's what happened. I woke up out of a blackout, you know, 12 hours later, no idea how I got where I did. And I went back and I told Megan the truth when I got back home, and I remember her breaking down crying, and it was like she knew something that I didn't at that time. And that started, the next 5 years of just lying, and, you know, what that did for an alcoholic like me is I knew she wasn't going to leave, right? Open up the doors for me to start, you know, hiding it out wherever, lying to her about it. But she always maintained, she was the one that got me in contact with my son. He was about 12 years old at that time. I had limited contact. You know, I always say I'd show up for photo ops, you know, around Christmas or birthdays sometimes. Most of the time I wasn't there. She provided a safety that was, you know, able to let my son come up and for us to bond. But in this time I struggled. I wasn't having a good time. I would put together, you know, where it says in the book, why can't he quit for her? Why couldn't I quit for my son? And I really wanted to, man. And it would be one more attempt, another DUI, one more attempt, one more failure. That's my mantra. One more attempt, one more failure. And I just couldn't put together any time. And I just got sicker and sicker. And so 2006, we ended up through a period of my sobriety. We got married. And September 17th, 2006, and we moved my son up that year. He was 16 years old. Moved him up because he was having some issues with his mom of his own. And so I sat there, that was the darkest year. You know, I'd done, like I always say, time in jail and time in prison. My brother always said, I drank to be free. And by drinking, I created my own prison. And in those last days, you know, where it talks about the darkness, my house, I'd created my own darkness. And there was times I pleaded with Megan to get up, you know, please just go get me some booze so I can get up and get normal and get out the door to get to work, maybe, or get whatever else that I needed to go get normal, right? And I'd put together, I think, about 20 days on January 1st, 2007. And I sat down and I wrote what we call a New Year's resolution, right? And at the very top of it was do not drink. And under that was be a better father, be a better son, be a better husband, be a better brother. And all I wanted to be, I can sum that up by be a better man. And I 100% meant it. You know, I was so done, and I had this 20 days of sobriety. Once again, you give me a lie detector test, 100%, I'm going to pass it. And January 5th, 2007, I get a DUI with my 16-year-old son in the car. You know, 5 days later, on my own willpower, that's as far as I could get. And those are the decisions I make. With no idea how I went out, I didn't plan to go out that night and drink, right? They say play the record all the way through. I always say that's kind of a treatment thing because my record says, hey, there's a beer, hey, there's a shot of whiskey, and I drank. There's no put the brakes on. There's no thought process, at least at that time. I had no defense against it. And so the thought must have crossed my mind, and I drank, and I get a DUI with him in the car. And once again, incomprehensible demoralization, and my wife and my father-in-law, Martin, have to come down and pick up me and my me and my boy from the police station. And I'm never going to drink again. Till 2 weeks later, I'm driving home from work, and once again, I have about a 10-mile drive home. And I live out in the country, one last market on the way home. And my car's on autopilot, and I swing in there. You ask an alcoholic, the big book says you ask an alcoholic 100 times why he takes that next drink. He's going to give you 100 different excuses. Once in a while, it's a reasonable one. But once in a while, you give the correct answer, and that's, I don't know any more than you guys know. We can't answer the riddle, right? It says that all over the big book. Yeah, I have no idea. And that takes me out on another 5-day drink, and in and out of blackouts, Megan had taken both vehicles, taken them over to her parents. And I just had a moment of clarity. January 23rd, 2007, I have a moment of clarity. I just can't do this anymore. And I knew I couldn't stop. And I called up Megan, and she must have heard something different in my voice because she had heard me, I don't know how many times, tell her I was sorry, right? And I said, can you just come back home and talk to me? And she sat down that night. And I just lost, for once, it felt like God had kind of punched me in the heart, and I just broke down in tears. I said, I can't do this anymore. I have a serious drinking problem. I need help. You know, I can't do this. And I laid down that night. I finished up the rest of my booze like a good alcoholic, and I passed out that night, and I woke up. Like I said, I worked swing shift, and I drove 10 miles to the noon meeting in Oregon City, Free to Be Me, and I walked up those steps, and my life changed. I'd surrendered. I walked up those steps, and what I always say is, you know, angels are messengers. You look that up in the dictionary, it's going to talk, the angels carry a message, right? And we all have a message. We all have a message of hope in this, right, for somebody. That day, there was a lady that delivered a message to me, and it wasn't, I didn't go to a check-in meeting, you know, how are we doing? She read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I call the meat and potatoes of the program, and she read from, but what about the real alcoholic? And I'll paraphrase here. Here's the guy that's been puzzling you. He builds his life up and tears it down with a senseless series of sprees. A real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He could, you know, drink around the clock if he can afford the alcohol. The whole thing. And I thought, she's reading to me, man. And it caused me to buy a big book that day. Actually, two big books. I always say I made my first act of amends on the way home. I drove by my wife's parents' house. They live right on the right side of the highway, and I brought in the second big book to my mother-in-law, and I said, here, I apologize for what's been going on, and if you read this, you probably figure out why I've been doing this all these years. I'm like, I hadn't even cracked the cover on my own, right? And so I make it home, and what do we say? I go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find myself on every single page. And I go back to the next meeting, and I hear hope, right? Hearing other people's experience. That's the acronym that I've heard. And I go back, and I hear it, and I hear I become accountable. What they did differently at that meeting, they said, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? And every single day, I'd raise my hand. I'd say, my name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. Every single day, my name's Aaron. And I'm like, God, this is the longest 30 days of my life, right? But it made me accountable. It made where I came into the room, people remembered me. You know, hey, Aaron, how you doing? You know, and that was different for me, you know. And I go back to that angel, that one that read that passage out of the big book. Why I say, I reflect on this stuff through the years. Like we do the daily reflection. I do the yearly reflections on, where was that one? I couldn't have told you anything else she said that day. I couldn't tell you anything else anybody in that room said that day. I couldn't tell you if she has ever came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that day she was a messenger and she read out of the big book, right? And that's what really flipped the switch for me to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was going through, coming to the meetings every day, and I was hearing a lot of hope. I was hearing people. I was like, God, this isn't like some of the guys that were sharing. I'm like, oh, these guys aren't choir boys, right? They're talking about beating up cops and stealing Mad Dog 2020. I'm like, I can relate to these guys. And so I'm digging through the meeting schedule. I'm going to try another meeting. This is a noon daily meeting. And I find a Canby Saturday breakfast meeting. And I thought, well, shoot, all these guys can afford breakfast, so they got to be doing better than me at this. So I, and that was how I, and I came in there, and that's what I heard in there. I come in there, and there was an electricity, and there is a power in that room, and it was the laughter and the just the energy. You could feel a buzz in there of people that were alive, right? And I had no idea that's what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I thought it was we came into one room once a day or wherever it was your group, and then you all kind of patted each other on the back. Yeah, it's okay, you know. Yeah, it was all just very melancholy, and then you went off to your own, you know, your own houses and came back and did the same thing the next day. What I heard in there was the attraction, right? Like people were talking about going to sporting events and going to concerts and stuff together and living life and having a good time, and they smiled and carried themselves in this way. It was like, I couldn't wait to go back the next week, you know? And so I started listening to the steps, and the people that I admired in the program that I'd been listening to had been talking about these steps. And so I'm going through there, and I'm reading the book every night, diligently, religiously. I'm reading this book just like they did back in the day when they would send it out to people. I wasn't reading it with somebody, but I'm like, and I'm going through these steps, and I'm learning from it. And it's, I'm like, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. You know, I'd been working on that step. I'd been working on that step for 20 years. You know, there was no doubt in my mind. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. All that says is God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him, right? I need a little crack of willingness, just a little bit. Open my mind, open my heart, and that's what I did. Because you guys showed me a way, you showed me an attraction that thought, maybe this could work, right? I knew my hurdle was going to be God. I just did. And so my third week, February 17th, 2007, I just came in with open mind, open heart, and there was a guy by the name of Ron that was sharing. He's still a member of my home group to this day, and he was sharing a message about how he'd been in a drunk driving crash in 1989, and he killed a mother and her two children. And he had done 8 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary. And he didn't have a sobriety date until, you know, we were talking about H&I, until somebody brought in a meeting. February 13th, 1989, a guy by the name of Chicago John brought in a meeting with some other guys to the Oregon State Penitentiary. And he pulled Ron aside after the meeting. He said, Ron, here's the deal. He said, you can't unring the bell, but you never have to ring it again. And Ron shared that story, and he shared a letter of forgiveness that he had from the victim's family that day. And I heard the feedback from the people that were in the room that talked about the humility, and that's how Ron was, as a humble man. And all of this stuff pieced together, and I come in with an open mind and an open heart, and I hear this message from this man, right? And I got to say, God bless anybody out here that does hospitals, institutions, treatment centers, prisons, jails, because I'm a direct result, honest to God, of a message that was carried into Oregon State Penitentiary on February 13th, 1989. And I heard that message carried to the outside of the walls on February 17th, 2007 in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here tonight because of that, right? A meeting that was inside the wall. So anybody, God bless you guys that do that. And because it's one message. We carry the message, one message that goes from one to reach the masses, right? We never know where that's gonna end up. And so I go home and I open up the big book and I find a passage in there. And it says, I'm looking for a prayer, right? I don't know how to pray. All I know is the people that were in this, that were especially in the breakfast meeting, they talked about the 12 steps. And when I talked to them out on what I call the porch outside, they would talk about their lives, right? Their jobs, their families. And they'd somehow seamlessly work these 12 steps into their lives. And there was no preaching about it. There was just like one alcoholic talking to another. And that's what got me interested in this. And Ron kicked the door wide open to a power greater than myself. And I went home, I dig through that book, and I find a simple prayer, and it's, Thy will not mine be done. And I hit my knees that night because somebody in the rooms is somewhere in the last 30 days, I don't know how to pray, but they say, it works better when you hit your knees. And I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to take whatever suggestions you got because you guys are doing something right. And I hit my knees that night, and Thy will not mine be done. And I feel a shift. I do it the next night. Thy will not mine be done. And I feel a shift. And I'm connected. 29 days into my 30 days, I'm in that distribution center. It's over 1 million square feet. And I'm holding that 24-hour coin. It's the heavy metal coin I got from the breakfast meeting. And I've got 29 rolling into 30 days. And I can't wait to go to that noon meeting the next day, right, and get my 30-day coin, because I've been waiting for, you know, and I reflect. And when I look back, when I read the big book and I read, you know, what goes on, you know, there's a meditation. What they used to do is they meditate. They think about the 24 hours ahead. I'm rolling in. I've got after midnight, and I'm thinking, I'm going to go get this coin, and my life is looking pretty damn good. You know, the relationship with my wife, everything was just clicking. I'd heard all the right things. I was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's something, I had connected to something, right? That was the difference. I don't care how long you've been in here. If we're searching for that connection, right, that's what we have. What lack of power, that's our dilemma. I had connected somehow to a power very early on, and I was on fire, man. You know, like a lot of us, I was on fire, and I came home, and it was about 2 a.m, and I opened my bedroom door, and my wife, Megan, she wasn't breathing, and I had to call 911. She still wasn't breathing, and they walked me how to do through CPR, and I'd never had to do CPR, and I got her on the floor. Anybody we can call? I said, yeah, call her dad, And I live in a small town. Sometimes in a small town, if you know, I felt like it took hours for the paramedics to get there. It was probably only 5 minutes, and I worked on her the whole time. Paramedics got there, and they said, sir, can we see you in the next room? And I knew right then she was gone. And her dad showed up, and he pushed through the door. She had epilepsy. She had only had 6 seizures in her entire life, all while she was asleep. They always told us they weren't life-threatening, but they were wrong. And her dad came in, and I said, Martin, she didn't make it. And he just brushed past me, and the paramedics grabbed him in the kitchen before they didn't want him to see his daughter. And he just collapsed. This big man just collapsed. His just knees gave. And I heard the sound of a father's heartbreak that night. And it's something, if you haven't heard it, you never do. And I never want to hear it again. And from there, we had to go tell her twin sister and her mom and her brother, and that's rolling into 30 days, up all night, and I don't make it to that noon meeting, right? And we're in shock. I was in shock for a long time. But what I do is, you guys have given me that connection, right? And this is all reflection through the years when I go back, and I knew what happened, and for a long time, you know, I clung to that 30-day coin, and I reflected. Did I really believe what I believed last night, 24 hours ago, right? I'm on fire for this thing. I have this newfound connection. I'm 100%. Positive, this is all going to be okay. I had a conversation with Megan on the phone that day. I told her I loved her. She told me she loved me. I saw it in her eyes that something was different, because something was different, right? And in that moment, what do? I pause, right? And what I'm doing is, I'm going, either God is everything or he's nothing. Either he is or he isn't. What was my choice to be? I take that coin, and I hit my knees that night, and I say, thy will, not mine, be done. And the next morning, 8 a.m, her father comes. I'm sleeping out in the living room, because I couldn't get back to the bedroom. And her father comes, and he opens that door at 8 a.m, and that was Saturday. And he said, this is the last thing I promised my daughter, is to get you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning, and you're going to get up, and you're going to go. And Megan had called him the night before she passed away and said, Dad, can you get Aaron to a meeting on Saturday? I have to work at the bank. And that man, he doesn't live next door. He lives about 5 or 6 miles away. That man, I was not his number one son-in-law. He didn't like me. He loves to tell people how much he hated me. It's just part of what he does. And but he fulfilled that one promise, right? Thy will, not mine, be done. Whenever I think about that, I think about a father's love and what it took for him to get up and to fulfill that promise and take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And what you guys did in that room that day is, I went in, and we broke down, and you guys cried with us. You guys sobbed with us. And they said, is there anyone here that has 30 days of sobriety? And I said, my name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. And that's where I got my 30-day coin. That guy that gave me the 30-day coin, we make lifelong friends in here, right? He's one of my very best friends to this day. Didn't know him from Adam at that time. There was a guy by the name of Steve Little that stood up, and he said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. When one of us hurts, we all hurt. And I've carried that with me ever since then. You guys surrounded us, right? When I talk about the 12 step, when we talk about the responsibility statement, right? That I am responsible. Those guys that came and stayed after the meeting, they didn't go, oh, I got to meet here. Whatever they had going on, there was a group of 6 or 8 guys that stood around me and my father-in-law because they were helping the alcoholic that was suffering, extreme suffering, right? 30 days of sobriety, and they took their time and they shared their numbers and they shared their experience. And there was a guy by the name of Phil who said, I had a daughter by the name of Megan who also passed away. You look at those little coincidences, God keeping his anonymity, right? What are the odds of that? And he shared, and Phil is still a home group member. One of the biggest guys, you know, I love that guy, right? And he stayed there with me, all those guys. And when I think about that back of those guys, either all of those men have died sober or they're still sober to this day. And why is that? Because they were working the 12-step of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were being responsible for what this thing is, and they believed it. And then when they see the newcomer, somebody like me, and I come back, right? And my father-in-law, he took me back to that meeting every Saturday for the next 3 years. He was fulfilling one promise to his daughter. Every Saturday, you guys let him share. Thank God nobody shut him down. He was a father with a broken heart, and you guys let him share and let him get that pain out. And he called himself the honorary alcoholic. And everybody kind of chuckled just like that to begin with, but they'd call on him, I want to hear from the honorary alcoholic. Because this thing can heal. Martin said he used to, you think, God, poor people, you know, you'd hear about a guy getting a DUI and, oh, that poor bastard, you know, and he's like, and I realized after going to those meetings that anybody could benefit from working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you healed that man. You helped to heal that man. You helped to heal our family. And I remember my mom asking me about 2 years sober. She said, does Martin ever share at those meetings? And I said, yeah, he calls himself the honorary. And I couldn't even get the words out. And I just broke down with all my heart, you know, just cried because he'd been saying he'd be honored to be one of us that whole time. And that man has showed up for every single one of my birthdays for the last 19 years. I filled he deserves that. I've filled an empty seat at his Christmas and Thanksgiving table for the last 19 years. That man calls me his son. At 8 years sober, he said, Aaron, I need to make an amends in front of my home group. He said, I won't tell you what he thought I was. He said, he's probably not, you know, good from the podium. But he said, he goes, I was fulfilling one promise to Megan to take you to that first meeting. And he goes, I kept taking you because I knew how important it was that you stayed sober, and I saw it was working for you. And man, that man did for me, you know what I mean? You guys pulled that together, and you guys gave us a family, man. And that family has done more for me than they ever should have. You know, a lot of families would have turned their back on me, and they didn't. And so from there, that was my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And for what those men stayed and did for me and stood behind me, you know, a week later we had to put together a memorial for Megan. You know, anybody that, she was 24 years old, anybody that's had to deal with a sudden death with like that, it's really hard to put something like that together. I couldn't say anything at her memorial, but my uncle, who I said, you know, played guitar, Megan mistakenly let me choose the music for our wedding, and I picked slowed down version of Johnny Cash, Walk the Line, for our dance song, right? And the only thing, my uncle got up there on an acoustic guitar, and I said, the only thing I could say was, this is the first and last song I danced to my wife with. And it's a promise, and it's a dedication, right? It was my promise to walk that line. And you guys have helped me do that every single day for the last 19 years, right? Because I couldn't have ever made that promise and fulfilled it on my own every day. And I was a guy that drank no matter what, you know, no matter what. And all the court stuff, I still had to go through all that. You know, I had to lose my license, all that stuff. I became, I had to do DUI intensive supervision program, which had lie detector tests. I had to sell my vehicle. I had on the old phone landline, I had a breathalyzer on my telephone, right? That's how intensive this, I'm not making that. It would look like an old 70s style radar detector. Took up my whole head when they'd call. I'd have to blow in that damn thing. And all of those little steps, right? All of that stuff that seems so tough that I come in whining about. I came in whining about this DUI with my son in the car, right? And I go through this, and all that stuff became so secondary that I progressed through this, and I became one of the very first to ever graduate that program early. And when I graduate from that program, all those guys that stuck around after that meeting that day sat in a wing of me at that graduation. They take you down to the district court and graduate, and then the judge, I remember her saying, you know, Mr. Zyback, I knew you would be here today. And I was probably the least likely to succeed that program. You know, I was a guy that didn't follow anything. And so I got through that. I won't get into my whole job thing. I don't have time. I want to hit on my brother. He called me up. I had one blood brother. And I knew he was out, him and my sister-in-law, right? I wasn't going to label them, but my brother drank like I did. And so, but I didn't promote this thing. All I did, I knew it was saving my life, and it was obvious to my family it was saving my life. I'm not the same man that came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you that, and my family will tell you that. And so August 1st, 2010, my little brother calls me. He's like, hey, I got to get Natalie doing his wife. I got to get Natalie doing AA meeting, right? She's stealing all my pills. She's drinking all my booze. I'm like, oh, my God, you poor bastard. We got to get her to a meeting quick. Right? We got to save your stash, buddy. And so I'm like, there's a 12 and 12 club. And I go, it's right down the street, about a half hour away. And about a half hour from there, and what they did is they handed my brother How It Works to read. And this is why I don't like messing with the readings. He made it about halfway through that reading, and he broke down in tears and just started sobbing, and something hit him in the heart. And both him and my sister-in-law have been sober since August 1st, 2010, together, right? That doesn't happen that often. And not only are they sober, they're active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's like when I talk to my brother now, when he calls up, sometimes I'm like, God, because I can't get off the phone with him in less than an hour, right? And that's the way it is. But I love that. I love that fact. And I climbed Mount Hood, 11,300 feet in the air, 18 months sober. And I trudged up that thing, and I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous all the way up. And it was a full moon. You stand on the top of that. When I got up there, the sun was rising. And, man, you can see the desert in Oregon. You can see the desert on one side, and you can see clear out through the ocean. Man, I tell you, you can't tell where the earth ends and the sky begins, right? And I take a pocket full of Megan's ashes, and I grab a thing of snow, and I throw those things to the wind. And I thank God, and I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for getting me to those places. And as close to heaven as I can get. And I get that stuff through working the 12 steps, right? And I get that view. And, man, I've had those views in Alcoholics Anonymous just living this life through the peaks. And we get peaks and valleys, and life goes on. But, man, most of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous has been looking off a peak like that, right? And it's a beautiful thing, man. If you're new here, I hope you hang on and join in. Like my buddy Tim says, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the greatest show on earth, right? And that's the truth. You jump in the middle of this thing, get in the middle, and we have a lot of fun. And got to do that. I've jumped out of airplanes, you know, stood with my toes over to the Grand Canyon and all that stuff. And I thank God everywhere I go because of that. And everywhere I go, if I'm at a meeting, if I go out of town, some of my family's like, oh, you got to go to a meeting? I'll go to a meeting as a thank you. Right? Because wherever I go, I get to thank you guys for it. I'm so grateful that I get to do stuff like this. And like Michael Ian said, I will never take this for granted, right? I will never take it for granted because, man, I couldn't even make it out to the coast. An hour and a half away, that was a vacation for me, right? I couldn't make it out of bed half the time. I get to do these things, right? I live a life of invitation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it. And I love you people. And I'll tell you about I've got to wrap up, but I'll tell you about the greatest amends. I've made amends with my son. I have a great relationship with him. I have two grandkids, great relationship. I've been there for both of their births. I have a girlfriend I've been with for the last 5 years, and I've been raising her son since he was just before he was 6 years old. And I couldn't ask for a better kid in my life. And I've been there for all of his baseball games, his first hit. His dad's not around. His dad will never be around. All his first baskets, you know, the first hit. And he'll look up, right, and catch me. You know, and he's too cool to let me know that, you know, it's cool that I'm there, right? But I know he knows. I get that look. And I'm so happy, and I'm so blessed I get to be able to do that. But at the same time, when I reflect on what keeps me here in Alcoholics Anonymous at moments like those, I remember that I've got a son that's 35 years old, that when he was 11 years old, There was no one there for his first basket. There was nobody there for his first hit, right? And I had to make amends for that. But I get a chance to be there for this boy. And, man, I couldn't ask for a better blessing. I couldn't ask for a better kid in my life. And he knows, like, I go to a meeting, you know, and his friends are over the house. I'm going to a meeting, and his buddy's like, this is a couple, 3 years, at like 8 or 9. His buddy's like, what meetings are you going to? He's like, don't worry, he's going out to save lives. And that's what I've never told him that, but that's his vision of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? He's going out to save lives. And, you know, we can turn things and make fun. You know, I was up, my mom wanted me to pick out a grave plot for her, and my wife Megan, she's buried up in this place, and Ulrich, that's his name, he was like 6 or 7 years old, and we're up there looking for a plot for my mom because she was adamant about us picking this up, and we go over, and I'm like, yeah, I was with my brother, and I'm like, this is where Megan's buried, and so Ulrich calls his mom a little bit later. He's like, hey, Mom, we're up here in the graveyard. Yeah, we found one of Aaron's wives. She's like, I got to laugh, right? You know what I mean? And I got to take those moments and have fun with them. And one of my wives just laying up there in the graveyard. And you know, I go up there, and every year I take her one of my sobriety coins, and I spend some time up there at the grave. And the greatest amends I've ever got to make is with my mom. And my mom, you say, she'd cried the blue out of her eyes when I go to jail all the time, and I ended up in prison, and I put her through the ringer. And the last several years of her life, she was in a care facility just right down the road from me. She had MS my whole life. And there towards the very end, last of 2021, her disease just progressed really quick. She was always really good mentally, but she couldn't walk anymore. And but man, I could make my mom, I'd made amends to her, and I would make her laugh so hard. You know, my mom would belly laugh, and I loved that. My mom had a smile that would light up this room. And because Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, when she started coming to the end, my brother was able to come up and make peace with my mom and tell her, hey, your boys are going to be all right. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, man. We give my mom peace, and I'm able to tell her the same thing. I don't deserve that, but by the grace of God, I get it. But I'll tell you what, my mother deserved that. My mother deserved that. And I was able to sit there to the end days. We'd listen to old Merle Haggard and listen to Johnny Cash. And I would just read to her so she could hear my voices. And in the very end days where she couldn't talk at all and she wouldn't respond and she wouldn't eat for anybody, but I could get her to drink. She could hear my voice. And I'd come in, I'd say, hey, Mom, it's Aaron, to the day she died. And she would light up that room and she would smile. No worries left, right? And I'd read out of this book, and I'm going to read it now, and I always say, you know, there's a part in the big book where it says, see where religious people are right, make use of what they have to offer. I'm just going to segue with that. I do a lot of reading, and this was a reading, I always say, from a spiritual giant out of Luck, Texas, and he nailed it on the head for what God was. And it's called God is a Four-Letter Word, and I'd been bouncing around. It was a bunch of essays in this book. And I'm like, okay, what? This has got to be some sort of joke. And this is the last thing I read my mother. And I believe my mom grew up in the plains of South Dakota. And I believe reading this, she knew I'd connected with God. And I can't put into words any better than this what God is to me and what God was to my mother. And I'll just read it to you. And it says, God is a four-letter word. No matter your religion, you likely have your own idea of what God is. Some think of God as that big guy in the sky who makes all the decisions for us. Some say God is a woman. Some say God is dead. Some say God never was. My view is simple. I believe that God is love, period. End of story. For love runs through every one of us and everything. Every one of us loves the flowers, and the flowers love the rain. If you love the ocean, you know the ocean lives and loves to caress the shore. Love is the thing we all have in common. We ache for love, we hope for love. We love and like to be loved, and that's God. Take these words of wisdom with you everywhere you go. Tell all the religions in the world, and through them the truth shall flow. But God is love, and love is God. That's all you need to know. It says, Dear God, the universe in which we're born is infinitely large, and each of us is so small. We search for meaning when the meaning is all around us. In every moment of our day, we search for you, Lord. We always have. We try to give you a form that we can understand. You've always been with me, in all of your many forms. I started in a Methodist church, but found myself at ease with every religion I've tried to understand. I can't tell you now whether I'm a Baptist or a Buddhist. Considering my footwear, maybe I'm just a Buddhist, a boot-wearing man who believes we were put here for a reason, and that by doing our best, we may find the light we seek. If not, our souls are eternal, and perhaps next time around, we'll do better. Spoke to me in the church, and you spoke to me in the fields and in the open pastures. Spoke to me in the songs of the mockingbirds and the blue jays who flew above us. You spoke to me through the rustle of the Texas wind and the trees and through the thunder in the night. And while I paused to listen, you still speak to me. Spoke to me through the music and the guidance from my mother who told me God always prevails because good and goodness can never be defeated. I wrote a song for you once called In God's Eyes, but maybe I wrote all those songs for you, just as all these songs were gifts from you. You were with me at the birth of my children, at the passing of my friends. You are with me when I gaze out on the blue bonnets of Texas. You're with me when the rooster crows at dawn. Feel you when I marvel and wonder at the brilliant rainbows of Maui and when I sing in the little frontier chapel in Luck, and when I stop for reflection on a quiet day at the Methodist church where my sister and I first lifted our voices to the heavens. The beauty of this world and the people in it, you have always been with us. You give us the power to see and smell and touch it. We are born of love, and it is love that carries us through. And that's what I believe. God is love, and thank you for everything you've done. My family thanks you. Society thanks you. I thank you with all my heart. God bless Alcoholics Anonymous.